Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world, recording with a 2023 MLB All-Star. I'm Jake Mintz, that's Jordan Schusterman, and we are joined by Brent Rooker, a member of the 2014 Plymouth Pilgrims of the NECBL. Brent, thank you so much for joining us for today's show.
Yeah, thanks guys. Appreciate you having me. I hope I'm always identified with my time in Plymouth. That'd be exciting for me. As a pilgrim, it's one of the highlights of my career, is for sure.
Well, I'm glad Jake decided to throw it back. I was going to keep it a little bit more recent. On Friday's show, we said we are going to have an active major leaguer on the show. And Jake went out of his way to tell everyone that it wasn't Shohei Ohtani. So he cleared it up. He said it wasn't Shohei Ohtani. So instead, we did one better. We got someone who has homered off of Shohei Ohtani. It is Brent Rooker. So thank you so much for joining us, Brent. We are not just going to relive the glory of hitting a home run off of Shohei Ohtani, although I imagine you probably have done that a few times this year because that was probably pretty cool, right?
Yeah, that was a cool one. That was definitely a cool one.
Okay, that seems fair. But Brent has been tweeting a lot, just like us. And that makes him qualified to talk about the Major League Baseball playoffs. As you know, you've been responding to all kinds of people who are probably less qualified to talk about the Major League Baseball playoffs.
Don't tell them that, though.
But we appreciate your insight. And you've also played against a bunch of these players. So we're excited to just kind of do the show with you. This is not just going to be interviewing Brent about his season. This is just going to be like, hey, you're co-hosting with us. So
yeah, I like
bear
that.
With us. As Jake and I try and figure out how to do a podcast with three people instead of two, but this is the right person to join us. So, Brent, I think we are going to begin with the American League, the league that you play in, right? That's you?
Yeah.
Do you have any American League pride?
Not really. I had a very brief stint with San Diego, so I have a little National League experience, but large majority of my career has been the American League. I think before the DH switch, I think there was more of kind of that divide, but now that everybody has it, it's just kind of the same.
It's funny, right? Because in college, it's like SEC pride.
Conference, yeah.
Like people ride with their conference, like, and then you get to you get into pro ball. It's like, no one's like, oh dude, the Eastern League, like that's my team.
We do. I mean, we spent a good amount of time as a team, just kind of like talking about how good our division was in general. I mean, I mean, between the Rangers, the Astros, the Mariners not making the playoffs is crazy because of how good specifically their pitching staff was with their team as a whole. And I mean, there's none of that like conference versus conference pride, but we'll sit down and everyone's probably like, our schedule is brutal having to play these three teams over and over again.
Oh, yeah. And then the other one has Mike Trout and Shohei Ohtani, which is not exactly.
Yeah, and I didn't even mention the two best players in the world on the other team. So
right. Right. So, and I do think that division pride is definitely a thing in baseball. That's the sad part is even the guys in the AL Central will be like, you know, everyone thinks we suck, but there's some challenging games here. Okay. Let's not get too, it's like, okay, sure. But it's not the same as the other divisions.
So. Easy. So let's hop into Rangers Orioles.
Let's do it.
The Texas Rangers against my Baltimore Orioles. Mm. It was not how I wanted things to go. I think that's a fair way to say it. This was not the ideal outcome as somebody who is born and raised an Orioles fan. I'm going to quickly run through the beats of game one very swiftly. Kyle Bradish was good for the Orioles as their starting pitcher. The Rangers started Andrew Heaney, a.k.a. Heendog. Heendog did the job, handed the ball off to Dane Dunning. He was also really good. When the bullpen piggyback works, it's very jarring and disjointing, especially against a lineup like Baltimore, which has been so good all season long. Rangers are up 2-1. Josh Young hits a homer, makes it 3-1. Then it's 3-2. After who homered to make it 3-2? Adley?
Santander
homered to make it 3-2. And then let's fast forward to late in the game, because this is when this thing went a little bit off the rails for Baltimore. Down 3-2 against Chapman in the bottom of the eighth, and Chapman comes in and he just has absolutely no command. No idea where the ball's going. Four-pitch walk. Just looks horrible. So actually, I'm curious about this, Brent. Like, if you're hitting and a team brings in a reliever who has zero GPS, are you just auto-taking at 2-0? Are you auto-taking at 3-1? What is the approach when a guy, because there's a difference between like the command is shaky and like this guy has absolutely no clue where it's going.
Baltimore was down at that time. So I would imagine they probably had, they're at least going to see a strike as a team. You're going to take till you get one, and then some guys who are more comfortable hitting with two strikes with lower strikeout rates and don't strike out as much probably will go up there and try to see two, I would think, whereas other guys who are a little bit more strikeout prone, you're going to see the first one, and then you're going to try to really zone them up, but you're going to swing it and try to hit a double, try to get on base in that way. But I would assume, yeah, knowing there's been times where Rollins this year hasn't really had his command there. I would think that you go up there and see at least one strike in that situation.
Did you see no command to Rollins this year? Like,
He threw against us once. I didn't get up, though. I didn't.
Okay. I'm just, that must be like bungee jumping.
it's
like death to
fight. It's jarring just because, I mean, one, the stuff is just so, so good. Like, if it's in the zone or near the zone, it's like, this is going to be tough. And then, yeah, just the knowledge that, I mean, the pitch he could miss big one direction to the other is concerning. But it's just like, he just goes in and out of it so quick. He'll have one batter where he can't find the zone, and then immediately goes back and he dots three fastballs at 102. And you're just like, all right, well, I don't really know what I'm supposed to do with that. But,
Well, the really interesting thing about Chapman, especially the last couple of years, is when he is completely losing it at 101, he has the slider.
He has the slider. The slider is the go-to strike pitch, yeah.
Yeah, which is absurd, right? And I know the splitter he's kind of broken at sometimes. But yeah, and also in the context of this game, this is also an inning after Josh Spores entered and threw seven straight balls. And because the Rangers bullpen has just been this theme the whole season, you just kind of have this feeling of like, okay, here we go. And yet they get out of it in the seventh, they get out of it in the eighth. And then in the ninth, Gunnar leads off with a single, Jake. And Gunnar Henderson, first of all, my goodness, what a player. Incredible hair, too. We've gotten a lot more Gunnar hair shots so far in the postseason without the hat, without the helmet, which has been nice to see. But Gunnar leads off with a single. Here comes Aaron Hicks. And then we have the miscommunication heard around the world in Camden Yards. As that's what Brandon Hyde deemed it after the game. We find out the next day it was a missed hit and run. You two gentlemen have played a lot more baseball than me. Brent, first of all,
okay, whoa.
Yeah.
You can't group me and him together in the same amount of baseball
sense.
Played.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that makes sense.
But I didn't lie. I did. You're right. I shouldn't have grouped you in, but I did. I didn't make anything up.
Okay, I'm just saying. It was a hit and run miss. I think it was a 3-2 or 3-1 count that he went on. Mm-hmm. When the pitch that Hicks did not swing at was like way out of the strike zone. Brent, what is the expanded zone of must swing on a hit and run? How far outside of it are you looking to go?
I think as long as it's not bouncing.
Okay.
Interesting.
I'm going to be honest with you. I don't know if I've ever gotten a hit and run sign in my entire life. So I wouldn't be the best person to ask that. But yeah, I mean, the funny thing about that play is like when I first saw it happen, so I got thrown out, I didn't think anything of it because I was just like, yeah, I mean, that's a situation where it makes sense to try to run. I mean, either way, right. Even hit and run, no hit and run, like Gunnar can run a little bit. Like it makes sense to try to get on second, get in scoring position there. So I was just like, oh, like they tried to run. Jonah's obviously really, really good back there, and it didn't work out. Whatever, it's just kind of a gamble that you take in that situation.
Right, and it's like Aaron Hicks hitting lefty. He's prone to rolling over a grounder to second base. If you send him early and he gets the bag, that moves him to third with one out, and you can drive him in.
Yeah, so in real time when I watched it, I wasn't like, oh, well, that was a missed sign. That was a miscommunication. I was just like, oh, they tried to run, get the scoring position, and Jonah's really good, so it didn't work.
But then they pan to Brandon Hyde in the dugout. And Brandon Hyde mouths, what the fuck?
And that's when you're like, oops.
Then you're like, that was not what was supposed to happen. Yeah. And so at first, everybody thought that Gunnar went on his own. But we later find out that Aaron Hicks missed the hit and run sign. And so Gunnar was a little bit hung out to dry. That's it for the O's. Hicks strikes out. Adam Frazier grounds out. Rangers take game one. Any other thoughts from game one, gentlemen? Any other?
Again, it was just like the Rangers pitching performance in that one when there were 18 different times when it was like, here we go, was very impressive. And then the Orioles, you know, young hitters until Gunnar at the end, it just wasn't quite there. So, but again, impressive performance. And then we go in to game two. And game two is a much different pitching matchup than Kyle Bradish versus a piggyback. This is Jordan Montgomery, who's been one of the best pitchers in baseball for the last month, versus Grayson Rodriguez. Oof. All right. So we have G-Rod making his first career postseason start and Jordan Montgomery rolling.
Brent, did you see either of these guys this year? Second?
Yeah, I saw. I want to touch on what you said first. I think Kyle Bradish is the most underrated pitcher in the league. Guy does not get talked about enough. I mean, he finished the league qualified with under a finished the year qualified with under a three, didn't he?
Yeah. Yeah.
We saw him at home later in the year. And didn't really, I mean, no one ever faced him before. And we kind of walked away after the sixth inning, what is happening right now? That guy's got three or four elite pitches and just dotting it wherever he wants. So I think he next year is going to be talked about going into the season as like a potential Cy Young guy. He's got unbelievable stuff and he locates the hell out of it.
And to be clear, he was great on Saturday. It's not like he didn't show up. I think he got like 22 swings and misses or something ridiculous. Like
his stuff's electric.
He did his job 100%. And now, speaking of electric stuff, we got some two electric stuff from Grayson Rodriguez in game two. And it is one thing, you know, it's kind of cliche to see, oh, young guy making his first postseason start too amped up. But when you're also throwing that hard, it can get kind of wild and wacky in a hurry. And especially with the contrast of Jordan Montgomery, who wasn't exactly throwing his best game, the pitch count was climbing for Grayson. And as you know, because you've seen it across the field all season, even if you're not pitching, this Rangers lineup just does not care. They will take their pitches and they will foul pitches off, and then they will absolutely hammer anything that you throw down the middle. And that is pretty much what happened in the first couple innings in this game. And this was after Aaron Hicks puts them up 2-0 in the bottom of the first. They're feeling good. Oh, the redemption for Aaron Hicks. He missed the sign, of course, blah, 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 all these cliche things. And before you can even start writing that story, the Rangers put up 5 runs.
So here's what I'm curious about, Brent, and you can give some good perspective on this. Like, it was the Orioles said after the fact that the game plan with Rodriguez was to go fastball heavy and to try and induce early count contact to keep his pitch count down and to get him deep into the game. It was clear pretty quickly that the fastball command was not there, right? He was throwing gas, but he was yanking it and he was missing spots and the heater was leaking back over the plate. At what point do you abandon that? At what point do you say, well, we drew up this game plan, he clearly doesn't have the heater? Because I go back and forth where it's like, there was no world based upon how amped up he was where Grayson Rodriguez was going to like get through 5, if that makes sense, because he just didn't have the command. But at the same time, you have to make an adjustment at some point, right? Or else I guess you end up allowing 11 runs.
Yeah, I mean, I think as far as pitching game planning goes, it might not be the best kind of just because, I mean, I don't know what those guys talk about in their meetings. The thing about that, I saw Grayson really early in the year, like second or third series of the year, and when he was a little bit more fastball slider than I think he's been, I think they adjusted later. He went more fastball changeup, and that changeup's really, really good. But the thing about trying to get early contact with him by throwing heaters is the heater is 100 and it's got a lot of movement on it. So, I mean, even if you're throwing him in the zone, like there's going to be a lot of foul balls and a lot of swing and misses on that fastball. So it's not like Jordan who's going to go out there and just throw sinkers at 92 and get a bunch of rollovers on command. Yeah. It's like, here's 100 at the very top of the zone. Like it's a challenge to put that pitch in play. So there's going to be swing and miss. There's going to be foul balls. So the pitch count is going to get up anyway, probably just by the nature of how electric his fastball is.
And that's the thing with Grayson, right? Is like, what a great reminder about how important fastball command is. Because you can throw gas, you can throw 100. And I guess even unless you're Spencer Strider and you have all the other elite characteristics on your fastball, if you throw it in the zone against a good big league lineup, they're going to hit it, right? And that's kind of what happened to Grayson. Second inning allows 5 runs. Rangers jump up 5-2. They take him out. Danny Coulomb finishes the inning. Flip to the next frame. Brian Baker walks the bases loaded. They bring in Jacob Webb, who allows a grand slam to Mitch Garver. We used to play Fortnite together, Mitch Garver and I, way back in the day when Fortnite was all the rage. Happy to see him get his moment against my team. And the Rangers go up 9-2. And at that point, it was Jover.
Well, you know, I assume Garver is one of the Rangers you know decently well.
Yeah, but he's one of my really good friends. Yeah.
Yeah. So Garver's had a fascinating season, and you'll probably you know, ride for him. I mean, he's one of the more underrated power hitters in baseball, right? I mean, not just dating back to 2019 with Minnesota, but just what he's done when he's been healthy. He did it this year. He finished with like a bad week, which basically bopped him from the DH, the starting DH spot. They had Robbie Grossman batting third and DHing for the first three postseason games. And everyone's like, what is going on? Why is this Robbie? All due respect to Robbie Grossman, who's like a clearly a veteran good hitter, who's capable, who's also had some good stretches, but it was like, why are we ditching Mitch Garver? But Bruce Bochy, who is going to get all kinds of praise for the rest of this month, and as he deserves, it reinserts him at the perfect time. He launches a grand slam over Baltimore, as we call it. And that was just – because the thing is, at that point, I mean, 5-2, the five-run inning before is tough enough. But if you're the Orioles, you're looking at it, and you're like, listen, it's three runs against the Rangers bullpen, against Jordan Montgomery, who does not look great. Like, this is something we can overcome. And we saw it later. We saw it as the game went on, right? Like they kept coming. That offense came alive. But 9-2 is just so deflating on so many levels. And the grand slam in that spot, Jacob Webb allowing, you know, a home run to the first batter he faced in back-to-back days is just really, really tough. And yeah, I mean, from there, again, the Orioles came Jorge Mateo four for four out of the nine spot. Like, the Orioles had some moments, but it was that grand slam just was so devastating.
Brent, walk me through your watching of the Mitch Garver grand slam, because like you say, he's one of your best friends. Like, he has done a lot to get back to this moment, to be, you know, a good big league hitter. So Where are you watching this, and how do you react to it?
I think I was over at my friend's house watching the game. We were just kind of growing up, hanging out, and he hit it up there. I mean, I cheered. I'm excited for him. He's, like I said, we're close. He's one of my guys that, like, if I'm struggling or I'm going through a week or two where I can't hit, I'm texting him. Like, hey, man, like, what you got? This is what's happening. We talk through hitting stuff a lot. He's really cerebral in terms of swing and approach and stuff like that. He dives pretty deep into it. So I was super excited for him.
There was so they're doing these in-game interviews like in the dugout, which I don't like really at all, but you know, occasionally they're interesting. And you know, we'll get to the Pablo Lopez one here in a second, but they did one with Garver, and he says something along the lines of, yeah, you know, 3-1, bases loaded, I had a pretty good feeling fastball was coming. It's like, yep. Fair point. Right, smart, like
sometimes,
smart lad.
Sometimes being a big league hitter is very hard, and sometimes it's like, you know, yeah, 3-1 fastball with the bases loaded. Like, I got
but you still
got
to be freakishly strong enough to launch it over the Great Wall.
I mean, that's the exact situation, though. Like you're saying, like, I got a pretty good idea. I'm not positive fastball's coming, but I got a pretty good idea. But I'm willing to just straight cheat. And if I swing and miss to the slider by 2 feet, then now it's still 3-2. Like, bases loaded, I'm still fine with that situation. But
yeah.
3-1 out here, I'm going to take my chances. And if the fastball in the zone, I'm going to hit it out front and try to end this game right now.
Yeah.
So the one element of this game I guess we haven't talked about yet, New York Rangers go on to win 11-8. The Orioles walked 11 batters. Corey Seager walked 5 times. Brent Rooker, you're a professional baseball player. Is it hard to win a game if you walk 11 guys?
Yeah, it definitely makes it tough. Those 11 free bases, okay, especially with a lineup like the Rangers.
And the thing with Seager, so first player ever to walk 5 times in a postseason game, so mazel tov to Corey Seager. But clearly, like, that is also part of what set up the Garver grand slam, right? Right, like, when you're pitching to Semien and Seager at the top, you are trying so hard to be perfect, and then you still have to deal with like 4 or 5 more good hitters, not to mention the swing Leody Taveras put on later on, and we see Young has been heating up and he's still batting 8th. Like, it is
the
really
depth,
a tough,
the depth
a tough
of that career. Lineup is just to have Nate and then Josh 7-8 is just like, there are no, I mean, Nate won a silver, sorry if you can hear my daughter yelling at me. I mean, Nate won a silver slugger last year and he's in the 7th in the playoffs. Like, that, the depth and like the amount of guys in the lineup that can hurt you is just crazy.
Yeah, 100%. But yeah, the 11 walks is not, I believe they were, Rangers were only the 4th team in postseason history to walk 11 times and record 11 hits in a playoff game. So that is a good recipe for
a lot of
success. And yeah, in some ways, I can't believe they didn't score more than 11 runs. So yeah.
It is the 9th time in MLB history that a team went 11-11-11. 11 runs, 11 hits,
11-11-11. Perfect. Well, there you go. I'm sure that it was like a side quest that the Rangers were attempting to achieve. And they did it. And they go up 2-0. And they return to Texas, where they have not been in 2 weeks. 2 weeks ago, they swept the Mariners at home. They're 2.5 games up in the AL West, and they are feeling good. They're going to go on the road. They're going to win the division. All is well. But instead, they have a tough road trip. They lose out on the division title. They have to go on the road for another week. But they have prevailed, and they have returned home to Globe Life Field, where they are going to be their one win away from the LCS.
Brent, does your daughter have any baseball takes?
Does she have any baseball what?
Thoughts, takes, opinions?
No, she really, really likes watching games. Like, she genuinely enjoys watching the games.
Same.
I don't think she has any takes. She knows when I get a hit, though, and she gets really excited, and it's very, very cute. Besides that, I think
what she was saying there was, hey, give some love to Cody Bradford. What a showing from
Cody Bradford's good. That changeup's real.
Cody Bradford coming in, giving multiple innings of relief. That was very impressive. I thought he should have finished the game, to be honest.
Rangers bullpen they have so many guys out there who can come in and eat like 4 or 5 innings. It's kind of set up as just like a bunch of piggyback long relief guys with then obviously Aroldis and Will at the end. But they've got so many guys who can eat 4 or 5 innings with no problem. It's pretty crazy.
That was impressive.
Let's move on to Brent's former team, not the Plymouth Pilgrims, though.
We can
talk
Plymouth, though, if you guys want.
You want to talk Grims? Go Grims.
Newport Goals, Ocean State Waves. We can break
I'll check in on the NECBL standings while Jake intros the Astros Twin Series.
This one is simple. We talked about it ahead of time, right? Like, we have so many preconceived notions about watching the Astros in October and what that means, and watching the Twins in October and what that means. And yet, I think what we have learned through the first two games is that these might as well be the Cougars and the Panthers, Jordan, because the vibes are a little bit different in each place. Game one was pretty straightforward. This was the game I watched the least because it was during and overlapped with Braves Phillies where I am. But my sense of it, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that Justin Verlander outpitched the Bailey Ober Kenta Maeda piggyback. And that is not to shame those two guys because it's Justin Verlander. The Twins fought back in the later innings, but that was pretty much it. Did I miss anything?
Well, I would say that like Verlander was not amazing in the first couple innings. And like when Altuve sets the tone by swinging at the first pitch and hitting it over the fence, which he's done a bajillion times, like you kind of know it's coming, but then you also remember that he's been there a million times and like this is what they're used to. Now the Twins battle back. Hector Neris was a total mess. He gives up a massive home run to Jorge Polanco. Twins make it interesting, but they end up hanging on. Brian Abreu, oh my God. There cannot be many more relievers better than Brian Abreu on this earth. I know he's not the closer because Presley is the capital C closer, but Brian Abreu, who, may I remind everybody, had a 0 ERA in 11 playoff appearances last year and has not allowed an earned run in, I think, 29 consecutive appearances this year dating back to July. He is a freak. He gets them out of the mess. The Astros go on to win. And I think the thing with Verlander in this one was his velo was up in his last start of the regular season. It wasn't quite there in this one. But as you know, Brent, like as cliche as it is, because it's not like he's throwing 90, I mean, the dude just knows what he's doing. Like he gets smart. Watching Verlander as the game goes on, you can just see him processing all this information and understanding, okay, I did that last time. Now I'm going to do this time. And execution is flawless. And even though he can't throw 99 anymore, it doesn't matter. He is just so in control. It is so impressive. I'm sure you've seen that up close.
Yeah, I mean, it's not the same electric stuff that we saw what 5, 6 years ago, whatever. But I mean, he's still Justin Verlander. The stuff is still plenty good enough to where when he has the knowledge and he has the pitch ability and he has the wherewithal to throw the right pitch in the right situations to the right place, that he's going to get a lot of outs. He's still really, really good. And it's really impressive to watch.
Yeah, he just is so unfazed by anything. It is so impressive. Of course, I think it was his 36th postseason start, you know, second most all time. So we've seen him do it so many times. And yeah, I'm eternally impressed with him. And also, it was an interesting contrast to what we saw from Framber Valdez in Game 2. I don't think there's anything else in Game 1 that we really need to hit on. There's way more fun stuff in Game 2 that I'd rather get to.
I just want to ask.
Yeah,
I want to ask Brent about Royce Lewis.
Oh, sure.
You were with him in the minors, right?
So we were the same draft. We never played together on the same team, but we were with each other in spring training and structs. I know Royce very well. Yeah.
When in the process of meeting Royce, did you realize he was special?
We got drafted in 2017. Yeah. He was our first pick. I was our second pick. And I don't think I ever really saw him play until the alt-site in 2020. I mean, I obviously heard, like, for his first at-bat in the GCL, he hit a homer, like, right after getting drafted. We all heard about that. You hear about how talented he is, how physically gifted he is. But I had never seen him actually do anything. I mean, I've been around him and met him. He is an unbelievable dude. Like, he is one of the more genuinely just nice and kind people you'll ever meet in your entire life. It got to the point where, like, he was so nice sometimes. Guys would be like, Royce, you need to be, like, a little bit meaner. Like, just, like, a little bit meaner. Stop being so nice all the time. No, he's unbelievable. But
it's funny because you have preconceptions of someone who's taken first overall.
Yeah.
Out of high school. Out of Southern California, right? Like, you're like, oh, this kid's going to come in with a signing bonus and think he's the greatest thing in the world. And, like, here you are, one of the best players in the SEC. It's like, all right, buddy, like, let's chill now. And it's just the total opposite.
He is the opposite of all of that. Like, seriously, there were times where guys would get on him and be like, you are too humble and you're too nice. You need to be a little bit, just a little bit meaner, have a little bit more of a chip on your shoulder. But obviously, whatever he does worked out. But 2020, the alt site, we'd be scrimmaging. And he would do, like, two or three different things in the span of two or three innings. Where you're just like, I genuinely don't know if there's anyone else on the planet, like, besides maybe Fernando Tatis, who can do, like, all three of those things that he just did. Whether it was, like, make a diving play at shortstop, steal a base, and then hit a ball, like, 440 backside. You're just like, that's just, like, and the kid's still 20, 21 years old at this point. Like, that guy's different. He stands out. You can put somebody who doesn't know a lot about baseball in the stands, have them watch a scrimmage. He's like, that guy's different than the rest of them. He is crazy talented. He's been a lot of fun to watch, and it's been cool to see him have the success he's had after kind of battling those injuries and getting back from it all, because, I mean, he deserves it.
We talk about it a lot on the show. Any 24-year-old with going bald with a goatee, like, that's a fucking ball
player.
He's a player. Like, that is a ball player.
Can I just say, and I we could talk about his game all day, and but just on the topic of him being nice, I'm jumping ahead here, but, and I can, you know, having interviewed him this season, like, yes, he is exactly that times a million. This is an all-time quote from Royce Lewis after game two. Okay. Royce Lewis on the atmosphere in Houston, quote, "I don't want to say anything horrible, but I felt like our Minnesota fans were actually louder. They acted like they wanted it more."
What a horrible thing to say, Royce. What a controversial and just, like, terrible take that is.
Royce, oh, I'm sorry.
He's trying so hard not to offend anyone possible. He wants everyone to love him, and everyone does love him. But he's trying to be so nice.
Dude, that's so great. He's, like, pandering. He's, like, half pandering to the Houston fans.
Yeah, catching you're not winning them over, man. Houston fans of all people is just so incredible.
Did you see the picture after Farmer hit the homer with Gray, and then Royce in the background, like, that's what he is all the time. Like, just,
it's so true.
The happiest, most genuinely excited person you've ever been around.
It is the best. I tweeted that screenshot. One of my favorite moments of the game. So let's get to game two. Fromber against Pablo Lopez. And let's start with Fromber, okay? Because this was not Fromber at his best. But Fromber, as you probably know, is the pitcher you have faced the most times in the major leagues. Did you know that?
Is that factual? I've said that in an interview before. Be like, I feel like this is true. And so it's good to know that is actually true. Yeah.
That is actually true. There is not, you know, it's still early in your career.
Probably 12 or 13 at-bats against them.
14 plate appearances against Fromber, including a home run, which you hit earlier this year, to the train tracks in Houston. But since you've seen, I mean, 14 times is that, once you see a guy over 10 times, like, I very much want to hear what that's like, because especially in a small amount of time, you're in the same division. So what is it that, I know we didn't see Fromber at his best last night, but he's been one of my favorite pitchers since he debuted. It's such a unique look, such a unique pitch mix and attack. So what is it about him? Because the curveball is certainly iconic, but he's mixed in the sinker. We've seen more of the changeup. So describe what it's like to step in against Fromber.
Yeah, it's just, for Fromber, it's just like the quality of stuff is crazy. I mean, on TV, I know you watch two sinkers, and it just kind of looks like two sinkers for, like, the same sinker, because you can't really tell on TV. But his sinker is different. Like, it's hard. it's so late. It gets almost to the zone where you feel like you're on it, and it just takes a left turn and just turbo like takes off to his arm side. And then the big curveball is a plus-plus pitch. He just spins it. He throws the crap out of it. It snaps out of the air. It's interesting for him because you hear all like pitchers trying to tunnel stuff. And because of his mix, like normally you tunnel a sinker with like a horizontal slider, and then you tunnel a four-seam with a down curveball. He goes like sinker curveball, which is just a little bit of an, like a bit of interesting profile because those are tougher to tunnel. So it's like it's not that you a lot of times – I mean, he'll throw a back foot curveball sometimes. It's really good that you don't see. But a lot of times it's not because you don't see the stuff. You can differentiate between the pitches. It's just they're both so, so good that they're so difficult to barrel because they move so late and they're so sharp and so, like, it's a power curve where it just kind of floats up in the air. Then you can tell the spin catches and it just nosedives to your back foot as already. So the quality of stuff is just crazy. And then obviously he can locate it. Maldonado does a really good job calling pitches for him. He knows Framber very well, obviously knows what his strengths are. He does a really good job managing the game four back there too, so it makes it tough.
Last night, though, he was a little bit shaky, allows up Carlos Correa. I want to call this during a moonshot double.
That is exactly what it was. Carlos
hit three balls last night. I thought all of them were over the train tracks and none of them were over the fence.
He got it was all wild. So the first one, the first double, he just got under it too much. He hit that thing so hard, he just hit it straight up into the in the air. That is what we call a Tampa Bay catwalk home run. Like that's hitting the roof. That's a roof ball. Easy. So that's a double off the wall, scores a run. Twins take a quick 1-0 lead. Kyle Farmer with a 2-run blast in the second inning, which was sweet. Kyle Farmer right only in the lineup because Royce Lewis cannot play defense right now. He's starting at third base over Lewis, and he comes up with the big moment.
Well, especially because he, you know, hits lefties well. They had Polanco at third in the first game against Verlander. More favorable matchup, better defense, too, to have Farmer playing third, move Polanco back to second. And Farmer has hit lefties. The other thing about Farmer that's just amazing to me, and you think about his season, he was the guy they brought in essentially as the Carlos Correa's probably leaving insurance. Obviously, they were probably hopeful that maybe Royce Lewis could play shortstop, although it seems like they have kind of settled into being comfortable with him being at third base. And yet Kyle Farmer found a way to still be a useful member of this team, regardless, which is so impressive. And now to see him in the postseason here is so cool. So they get on, Framber early. They're up 3-0. They go up 5-0 in the fifth inning when Carlos Correa facing Framber for a third time. This was a situation where had Correa not, blasted a ball earlier and drawn a walk, I would have, again, like I said, like I love Framber. I'll ride with him here, stick with your starter, whatever. Not going to the pen in this spot was felt a little questionable, I would say. Correa makes him pay. It's 5-0 Twinkies. Let's pause to talk about Carlos Correa. Let's just do the Carlos Correa conversation. I mean, this dude is making an impact literally every second. It feels like, and it was cliche coming into it. Of course, we assumed he would be the star of the show. But, when you mentioned Jake, oh, what do we assume coming into this? The Twins, they've only been in so many postseason games. The Astros have been in a million. Well, what we do know is that Carlos Correa has been in all of these, and now he plays for the Twins. And it is just incredible. It feels like everything that is happening with them, he has something to do with, whether literally or like he is the one. It almost feels like he's calling pitchers sometimes. It feels like he's the one telling hitters, hey, look for this thing, because I know all these pitchers as well as anybody. And I feel like you sense that too, watching too, right, Brent?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, he is obviously an incredibly special player, and I was only with him for, I guess, 2 weeks that first spring that he signed in Minnesota before I got traded. But it was pretty apparent even those 2 weeks in the clubhouse, like he is a sensational leader. Guys gravitate to him, one, because of the way he carries himself, and then two, just because of his track record and his pedigree as far as regular season and postseason stuff. So watching him hit in the postseason is really special. And like you said, they had one meeting where Yordan was up, and he went. Or Pablo called Brian out there and Carlos went out there too. And it seemed like he was kind of like directing the meeting a little bit, kind of saying like, hey, he's probably looking for this right here, or this is what we need to throw. And then,
the change up.
That 3-2 change up.
Oh my gosh. And Pablo like turned around and he's like giving the fist bump and looking at Correa. And it's like, oh, like this dude's literally orchestrated. Now, obviously Lopez was sensational. I mean, this is the best anyone Pablo has seen. He is a freak. He is so talented. He is so, talk about cerebral, talk about execution. But now he has the stuff playing up. It's not just he's throwing 93, 94 and he knows what he's doing with it. He's pumping 97 in the sixth, seventh innings. Now he looks like one of the best pitchers on earth. The execution was just tremendous. Obviously, Jeffers, he gave Jeffers a lot of credit. It seems like Correa had a big part to do with it too.
Yeah, just a quick Correa thing, and then we can kind of wrap this game up. Like, my understanding of Carlos Correa has shifted since what happened in 2020. And I mean that in the context of he became the face of it during that spring training where he had to eat it, right? And yeah, he transgressed and he broke the rules and they did the cheating. But when he took the mic at spring, right, like right at the Astros complex, you can picture that interview, right? We all saw it a million times. And he ate it. Like, he went up there and he took it and he put the heat on himself. And as, you know, people following the game, and for you as someone who was in another organization at the time, like, it's super easy to villainize somebody for doing that because it comes across as like, this dude is a jerk. Like, he has shown no remorse. What I have, and maybe this is like not giving Astros land enough credit, what I have come to realize about that moment now is that his priority was to take the heat off the 25.
Get it off his teammates. 100%.
Exactly. And like, that is really a selfless decision in the context of that environment where he knew that that team was going to have to go through the adversity of carrying the trash can bullshit all year, right? He knew that. And he was like, well, half this team wasn't here in 2017 and they don't deserve to have to think about this all the time. And so I'm just going to make it about me. It's very European soccer manager. You know, when like Jose Mourinho used to say a bunch of insane shit so that no one would ever criticize the players, they would just criticize him, you know? And like that moment, I think, is really important in understanding the way that Carlos Correa thinks about leadership, right? Where he wants the smoke so that the 25 other people in the clubhouse can kind of move.
I think you're absolutely correct. Can we talk about Houston fans booing him?
Yeah. Yes. Yes.
Wait, so what are you doing?
So two things. Tyler Stafford, one of our good friends, one of our favorite Astros fans, he had a great tweet that was basically like, how can Astros fans who have watched Correa thrive on negativity for the last however many years think that booing him was a good idea? Yeah. That is so spot on. Now, as for why like they were
sticking,
booing him.
It's like sticking your finger in a light socket. It's like,
one, he won you two World Series, right? One World Series, sorry, and like 17 ALCS.
100 postseason games, yeah.
Yeah. Two, you didn't try to get him back. It's not like he left on his own volition. Like,
To resign him. Are you booing your owner? Like, what?
Yeah. Three, and then three, like you said, I was talking with my buddy, he's a big Astros guy, and he was saying the same thing. He was like, if we're booing him and we're making him 25% better, like, what are we doing? You're hurting yourself booing him. He feeds off this.
You know what it was?
4 years.
You know what it was? Astros fans, they know that everyone else has been booing their players for years now, right?
They were like, somebody.
They're like, I guess, like, I'm boo Royce Lewis. He just called you quiet.
Yeah. Very politely.
Yeah.
Very politely.
That's true. But anyway,
that's amazing.
The point is, I thought that was funny too. I mean, I think there's different categories of boos, right? There's boos out of respect for the opposing best player. There's boos because we are mad at something you've done. But either way, the just horrible cell phone.
Make any sense?
Yeah, just
the three buckets of boos for me. Okay, there's the you're good, we boo you. That's the Acuna in Philly, Harper in Atlanta. We are horrified of you. We have no choice but to boo. There's the you have like cheated on the field of baseball. So that's like steroid guys and Astros trash can stuff, right? And then there's like you did crimes and you're still playing. Those are like the three buckets of boo. And then I guess the fourth is specific disrespect towards a fan base. So that's like Cole Irvin with the Mariners, Jordan.
Example
of this.
Yep.
Right? Like where a player calls out a team in some way, or like Randall Grichuk like crushing the Orioles would be another example of a guy who would get booed in a specific place. The Correa one fits in none of the buckets.
None of the buckets. Yeah. There was no logic behind it.
The last one, which is really kind of as an Orioles fan, is kind of I hate that they used to do this. Booing Mark Teixeira because he was like from Maryland and like didn't sign with the O's in free agency. That was the dumb one. It was like, yeah. Well, what you thought he was going to turn down the money so he could live in like Montgomery County?
One more thing on this series before we take a quick break and return with the National League. I mean, Twins winning this one at all, snapping a 12-game home ALDS winning streak for the Astros. They had not lost an ALDS game at Minute Maid Park since 2015. So that is how much of an achievement this Pablo Lopez game was. However, we need to take a moment to talk about Yordan Alvarez because, Mr. Rooker, as you are someone who I've watched on MLB Network explain why hitting is very hard and explain what makes a hitter good, all these things in a very intelligent way. And so I know we've been asking you about a lot of pitchers, what you've seen from them. But with Yordan in particular, when you watch him, what is it? What are we seeing with him? Because I am just in awe, have been since he debuted.
Yeah.
Obviously, he ripped my heart out as a Mariners fan last year three times. And it's funny because coming into the series, it was like, oh, there's some parallels to this to the Mariners Astros series last year. Well, maybe this time Yordan won't, you know, hit a bunch of crazy home runs and then they'll win. Whatever. It's like, oh no, he actually will.
He's going
will
do that. Every time.
So take it away. You're watching him in the box, and you know, like you said, like you can get him. He had some strikeouts here and there, and he's even gone cold for stretches in October over the last few years. But this just, I mean, the kinds of home runs he's hitting on these pitches is so funny. As soon as Lopez is out of the game, he's like, great, time to homer again.
He doesn't hit cheap home runs. Every home run he hits is just like the most majestic thing you've ever seen in your entire life, where he hits it 118 miles an hour. He is a guy where when we're playing Houston, which we do a lot, obviously, and I DH a lot, so there's a lot of times for the dugout, I go back on the iPads and I watch every single one of his at-bats. Like, I watch all his swings, all his takes, everything, just because I think his swing is so good. It's just like the most powerful. It's everything's coiled to the max, and then he just holds it to the last second and just unleashes on everything. And it's fun to watch just because he can hit so many different pitches. Seemingly, I think last night he went back to left center, right? But seemingly he can hit anything pull side hard, no matter where the pitch is, which is impressive. Off the plate in, lefty sliders breaking away from on the black away. He can get the head out and pull all of them for doubles and homers, and it's incredible to watch. He's so strong. Just so strong and so powerful. And so the swing is tight and compact, and just it's I mean, he's one of the best hitters in the game for a reason, obviously.
Yeah, it's my goodness. He'll never cease to amaze me at this time of year. All right, let's take a quick break. And when we return, we are going to review the two National League games that we have seen so far, Braves, Phillies, and of course, D-backs and Dodgers.
Hey everyone, producer Chris here with a quick housekeeping note about our merch. Look, in Australia, we love clothes and almost always wear them. If you're like us and also enjoy dabbling in clothes wearing, then why not consider some official Baseball Barbercast merchandise? Whether it's a jumper you're after, which you would call a sweatshirt, a cap, which we would call an old hair hugger, or a shirt, which we would call a belly wrap, we have it all for you. But that's not all. Do you also like to drink water or caffeinated beverages? Well, that's great because we have mugs and bottles to help you quench your thirst too. To buy any of this merch, go to podswag.com/baseball. The link is in the description of the podcast. And don't leave yourself clothesless this.
And welcome back to Baseball Barbercast. Jake Mintz, Jordan Schusterman, and Brent Rooker. Let's go out of order and do D-backs Dodgers, because this game one was pretty straightforward. Not a lot to pick apart. Clayton Kershaw, a future Hall of Famer, one of the most revered, respected, and greatest pitchers of his generation, walked out to the mound at Dodger Stadium with a hurt shoulder that he'll never admit, a 90-mile-an-hour fastball that got him to a 2.7 ERA against all odds this season. And before most Dodger fans could take their seats, stuck in traffic in the parking lot, he was out of the game, obliterated by the Diamondbacks. The word here is ambushed. This was an ambush, scoring 5 runs off Clayton. He recorded just 1 out, and that was it. From then on, it was a boat race. The Diamondbacks win this one 11-2. I was bummed out. This was hard to watch. It was like a grandparent starting to lose their memory in a way, where it warps your understanding of what they were at their peak. I do not want that to be my last memory of Clayton Kershaw. That would be so unfortunate. And I hope that he gets another start in this series, and I hope that he shoves in it, because that was not Clayton Kershaw on the mound, right? That was like blatant Blershaw. Like, that was not him. And so that was a really hard watch.
I also am interested, before I kick it to Brent here, like, you mentioned, like, he had been so good in the regular season somehow with the same stuff. And what it reminds you, against Arizona, like, a few weeks ago, like, he had done this against Arizona. Like, it's not like he had not succeeded against these same guys. Now, we have to remember, there's a reason that there was even more pressure on Kershaw on this spot, is because all the Dodgers pitchers either got hurt or arrested. Like, that's, you're in a situation where, were they probably going to find a way to give Kershaw the ball in game one anyway? Yes. But it makes the rest of the series a lot more precarious, and we'll see what rookie Bobby Miller can give from them. You mentioned the term ambushing, and is that's something I'm curious from your perspective, Brent, from a game planning perspective, like, is that, not that you ever expect to put up five runs in the first inning, but have you, I assume you've been a part of some big first innings where it's just like, we're going, and I'm more compelled to swing early because I'm seeing my teammates have success.
Yeah, I mean, the old adage, whatever, hitting is contagious. Like, if you see two guys in front of you, swing early in the count and find barrels and do something productive, then yeah, you're going to go up there looking to do the same thing, be aggressive. I think it starts with the first guy doing something, and then just kind of passes down from there, and you try to move the line along. And you learn from the bats in front of you, right? If you guys go up there having success early in the count, swinging at the first couple pitches, you're going to do the same. If guys are going up there seeing a few and they're having success like that, you're going to be more prone to do that as well.
Yeah, so I know, the Diamondbacks were, yeah, you could tell, or like, they were seeing it well. They were taking big swings off Kershaw in a way that you don't often see teams approach him. Like, I know even when he was great, like, the way that you get him is to get him early in counts, because if you get behind and he throws the slider or the curve, like, you're done. But like the Gabby Moreno homer, that was not a safe hack. You know what I mean? Right. Like, that's not a hack you take against a pitcher who you're not seeing well. And so that's what was kind of concerning and sad for Kershaw. Any other thoughts about this game? I really don't have a whole lot else.
Well, I just want to say, like, for you, Brent, I know as a proud American leaguer, proud American, how much you've been locked in on the Snakes. But, like, you know, Kershaw leaves the game. They put up a bunch more runs in the second, you know, off of Emmett Sheehan. Like, Corbin Carroll is, you know, going to be really probably good, you know, unanimous NL Rookie of the Year. Like, I'm just curious which D-backs hitters, both in this game and in the round before, we saw so many contributions from this team on both sides of the ball to beat Milwaukee. Who's kind of stood out for you on Arizona's side that's been really impressive?
Yeah, we played them really early, and I think besides Corbin Carroll, who's obviously developing into an absolute megastar, they lack the big name guys. Like, they don't have the Mookies and the Freddies and the Ronalds and the Matt Olsons and the guys like that, but their lineup is just so deep. Christian Walker, I think, is one of the more underrated hitters in the game. He puts up numbers every single year hitting. I mean, he always seems like he hits 260, 270 with 30 plus homers. He's an anchor in the middle of that lineup and does a great job. Another guy whose swing I watch consistently to try to learn from. And then you've got guys like, obviously, Corbin in there. And the Moreno kid's really special. He can swing. I just think that the depth of that lineup, they have a lot of really, really solid guys who are really good hitters. And I think that makes them scary in the postseason, because they can consistently put together really quality at bats top to bottom. Yeah. And I think that's scary when you face the like the elite starting arms. There's not a lot of easy outs. You're going to make those guys kind of grind and get the bullpen maybe a little bit earlier than you would in the regular season. So I think that they're sneaky. They're not sneaky anymore, as they just beat the Dodgers game one. But I think a lot of people maybe underestimated them coming into the postseason. But the lineup they have and some of the arms they have, they can compete with anybody for sure.
And I love that Torrey Lovello had a quote, I think it was yesterday during the off day or after game one, where he was basically like, yeah, like, everyone who's saying, oh, like, reseed so that the Braves can pick on the lowly Diamondbacks. Like, these teams are all really good at this stage. And as we've seen, like, think about everything we thought about these teams as soon as the regular season ended, whether it's Texas, whether it's Arizona, who looked horrible in the final week. Arizona did. Texas losing on the final day, you know, giving away the division, stuff like that. Like, all these things, it's just whether you want to blame the layoff, whether you want to blame all these different things, whatever, like all these teams are good enough to where they can turn it on. And that's what we've seen from Arizona here. It's been so impressive. And Bobby Miller's got, I mean, this is not going to be an easy assignment in game two here, especially because, this lineup is just so many different guys who contributed. And congratulations to Merrill Kelly finally defeating the Dodgers on his 17th try. I know he had quite the lead, so it wasn't much of a stressful outing. But Merrill Kelly, another very underrated pitcher, I would say. Good to see him get that dub. All right, that's D-backs Dodgers.
Well, I just want to say, spinning it forward for game two, like Zach Gallen with a chance to go up 2-0.
Zach Gallen is good.
It's a good pitcher. All right, thank you, Brent.
Really good.
Thank you, Brent. Good to have the insider perspective.
For Zach Gallen is that guy is really good.
That guy is really good. Okay, Braves-Phillies, game one. I am here in Atlanta as your fifth favorite Phillies beat writer. Game one here in Atlanta was pretty straightforward, believe it or not. Not in the way we expected. I think no one had Braves offense doesn't show up on their bingo board. Ranger Suarez was very good. Did not allow a hit through the first 11 batters before Matt Olson knocked a single in the fourth. One other runner reached, and Suarez was pulled with just two outs in the fourth inning. But then the Phillies bullpen held it down. Six different relievers. Jeff Hoffman, a.k.a. Hoff Daddy, finishing the fourth inning before five dudes went one inning apiece to give the Phillies a 3-0 win. The runs were scored on a Bryson Stott RBI single, a Bryce Harper laser beam home run on Spencer Strider, and a very bizarre catcher's interference call with the bases loaded in the eighth inning. Let's kick it to you, Jordan. I was at the game. I watched it very closely. From afar, sure. What was the vibe?
So first of all, Bryce Harper reaching base four times. We were underwhelmed by him in the two wildcard games. He shows up against Strider. Strider was awesome. He was awesome. I mean, you could say, hey, well, they still lost. This is the first time the Braves had been shut out at home in 2 years, I believe, which is an incredible stat. That says a lot. But the pulling Ranger Suarez where they did and then using six relievers, including a full inning from Orion Kerkring, the rookie who's pitched like for 5 minutes in professional baseball, was just so impressive. And yeah, I mean, they just seemed, this Braves offense just seemed out of sorts. You want to blame it on the layoff? I don't really care. Like when you have that many good hitters, I don't want to hear it. Like you gotta be scoring runs against the, not that Ranger Suarez isn't solid. Like that just hasn't happened the whole season, and it suddenly happened. So,
Brent, what was was your takeaway from that? To see such a dynamic offense go so quiet in the first game.
I mean, I think it's pretty easy to blame on the layoff, right? You lose rhythm, you lose maybe a little bit of timing those few days. But I think it just speaks to baseball, right? That lineup's been so good all year that at some point, I feel like they're bound to just go through a little bit of a lull. You just hope it doesn't happen at the exact wrong time, which is kind of what it did.
They still hit a lot of balls hard at guys.
Yeah, I mean, they're going to do that. And I don't think there's any holding them down like that for 3 or 4 games in a row. So I'm sure they're going to bounce back and put up some runs there in the next few games.
It was super just weird to watch. You know, like Acuna in particular, I thought the Phillies had a really good game plan against him. Where do you beat Acuna? You have to go inside. You have to get heat and velo in under his hands because he is better than anybody else in the world at taking. Most people have a hole up and away with velocity, right? Like you can beat 90% of big league hitters that way. Acuna is the opposite. That's where he wants the baseball, right? He's going to take that pitch out the opposite way. So you have to get in under his hands. I thought Suarez in both of his at-bats against Acuna got him swinging early in the count with a pitch in under his hands, got him out pretty quickly. So that's a big part of it. Like if you can keep Acuna off the bases, like you're going to give yourself a good shot to stay in the game. But yeah, like you said, like Strider did it. I was expecting going into this game that Strider was going to be the story one way or another because of what happened to him last year, pitching against the Phillies in the NLDS, struggling because he had an injury. And it was like, well, either he's going to be bad and the Braves are going to lose, or he's going to be good and they're going to score more than, you know, 3 runs, and then it'll be the story. But he really wasn't. That wasn't the takeaway.
No, I mean, he and I don't solid. Think you've faced Strider yet.
No, I haven't. I faced him in spring training. I guess last year is when he like initially blew up, right?
Yeah.
So I faced him in spring training last year with Minnesota, like when he was still pretty under the radar.
Yes.
And I remember he threw like two innings against us. I think punched out five, and we were all just kind of like, "Who is that? Like, why don't we know who that is? And what's going on here?"
Yeah. Yeah, but okay, so you haven't really seen it, but that's still pretty much right when it was starting, so you did get at least a little taste of it, but he pretty much delivered everything you can ask for. I mean, he's to say, like, again, they have never been that not been shut out of home the entire season, and they didn't even really get close. Like, how often did they have anybody on second base the whole game?
So they had the biggest moment for Atlanta was bottom of the eighth, runners on first and third, and Trey makes that diving play
from
play to his left. An incredible effort from Turner to stop with the throw to first to end the inning. And that was it. Like that, once they got out of that inning, that was deuces. Kimbrel locks it down in the ninth. Let's quickly talk about the catcher's interference call. So let me start with this. Brent Rooker, is it okay to ever throw trash on the field? When is it okay?
No, you should not do that.
It's never okay?
You should never, never do that.
Are you sure?
In any situation, you should never do that.
What if there's not a trash can? I'll
stand pretty firm in that take.
What if there's not a trash can near me and I'm mad about something?
The field is not the place to dispose of that.
Don't throw it on the field?
Don't throw it on the field.
But what if that pitch was totally a strike? I can tell. Yeah. I'm sitting 300 feet away. Trust me. It was a strike, okay?
Yeah, keep the cans and the trash off the field.
Okay, fine. So
fine,
which is weird. Again, it's another thing where you're just like, you're making your own stadium employees clean it up. Like, what are you? Who are you punishing?
You make your own players. Acuna's out there taking a track. You're punishing
your own stadium employees. Like, what are you doing?
So, a little context here. Bases loaded, one out. JT Realmuto takes a swing, two outs. Nicks Sean Murphy's glove. Catcher's interference call. Here is it on the replay. It was very tough to see. Admittedly, like the replay was inconclusive. Here's how you know it was a catcher's interference, okay? Sean Murphy and JT Realmuto are two of the best catchers in the world, if not the two best catchers in the world.
Yeah, they could be the two best, so
They could be the two best. Realmuto turns around immediately and points it out. Murphy, when it's called, his reaction is not to, like, argue back at the umpire. When you see him smack his helmet against his knee, that's him being pissed at himself, right? A great way to know what's going on a baseball field is to watch how players react to calls, because you guys cannot throw poker faces on in the moment. It's very hard to do. And so for us who are trying to cover the game, like, I often just go off of the way that players react. And you could see from that reaction, even though you couldn't see it on the replay, that it was a catcher's interference call for sure.
I mean, I just feel like, first of all, catcher's interference is just one of the funniest. And when it's catcher on catcher crime, that's also when not just the two best catchers in the league, but it is such a rare play. I do agree that the replay was a little goofy. But yeah, I generally, you guys are not the best actors in the world. Like, I know what I have. Same thing with hit by pitches also, for sure. This is the same thing all the time. Like, guys are not very few guys are actually that good at faking it. And you can tell. So,
do you guys, this is a question I just probably know the answer to. Is there an umpire's discretion rule that they can determine that you hit the catcher's mitt on purpose?
So this is when catcher's interference is way more interesting. And there was a case a few years ago when Jurickson Profar got a catcher's interference against the Dodgers, and Kershaw was pissed. I don't know if you remember this, but on the replay, I mean, it's a tough look for Profar. Like, it looks like he's like reaching back and hitting, which is obviously, first and foremost, extremely dangerous and terrible, right? Can't be doing that. And Brent's daughter agrees that swinging at the catcher's glove is completely unacceptable, right?
Don't do that.
But is it an unwritten rule thing, or is there an actual rule that they're like, no, you did that on purpose, like, you gotta stay here?
I don't think the rule book allows for the umpire to decide that. I think that's.
So, I could have 1,000 on base percentage extra if I wanted to.
So, like, Brent, it's funny.
And look at the pitcher. Just look at the catcher and just.
So it's funny you say this, because my high school baseball team was horrible, really terrible. And we had a kid on the team who had never played before, but he was a good athlete and he was our starting center fielder and he hit ninth. And when I say had never played before, like, had never played the sport before. And he was 15, okay? And he was our center fielder. Good athlete. I taught him to swing at the mitt. I did. It's a immoral thing that I did. I admit that in retrospect. But I was like, bro, you're going to stand in the back of the box and you're like just going to kind of like for the first two strikes, you're just going to reach back. And he had 8 catcher's interferences in a 14-game season. Okay. Is that a shame? Yeah. Would we have won the title anyway? You know it. No big deal. So yes, it is probably frowned upon if you do it over and over again.
I mean, for, listen, I'm not going to do it, but like theoretically.
Correct.
You could. Correct,
theoretically. Yeah. Dude, you would get thrown at so... Could you imagine if you developed a rep?
Yeah. You'd be on base every time. It should be either catcher interference or you're getting hit.
But if you want an example of the closest... Just look up Profar Kershaw catcher's interference and you will see it was not a pretty sight. Yeah. All that said...
Let's spin it forward to game two, Jordan. That is tonight here in Atlanta. Zach Wheeler against Max Fried. Oh, baby, that is a good one. Wheeler was dominant in his wild card start against Miami. Fried is kind of in an odd spot right now. He has a blister, maybe, or doesn't. He missed the end of the regular season with a blister issue on his left throwing hand. Had a tape over it when he threw the sim game in the scrimmage that the Braves had in their stadium. He threw 4 innings with the tape on and 1 without it. And it is unclear how much that is going to impact him. Sometimes blisters are a huge deal. Huge deal. Sometimes they don't mean anything. And we just have to, we won't know until he pitches because we don't know the severity of the injury.
We last saw Fried pitch on September 21st. Allowed 1 run over 6 innings against the Nationals. And then the start before that was 5 innings and 1 run against the Phillies on September 12th. So it's been a while, but as you just mentioned, Jake, he has pitched in a sim game. This is a delicious matchup, of course. Brent, why don't you finish us off with this? Just thoughts on this the remainder of this series, and especially Wheeler and Fried.
Yeah, I think before the postseason stuff started, before we even knew what the matchups were, Philadelphia was kind of my pick to win it. I think that they are. I think the lineup is scary, and I think the back end of their bullpen is what you're looking for in a postseason. They go 7-8-9, they can shut you down pretty quick, and obviously their starting pitching is solid too. So I think this is gonna be a really good series. I think both the guys throwing the night obviously are electric, they have really good stuff and are gonna go out, and they're gonna command the game just because they're two pitchers of that quality, but the two lineups are also as good as they come. So I think it's gonna be an entertaining watch at least.
So you saw Wheeler this year, you did not see Fried.
Yes.
My sense of Wheeler, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, is that what makes him elite is that he has 2 fastballs that come from the low slot, right? Yes. He's throwing the 4-seam riser and the sinker that gets in on your hands. When you're facing a guy with 2 fastballs, 2 that act totally differently, how does that complicate your approach as a hitter?
It makes it so much harder when guys have 2, especially like plus, 95, 96 fastballs, just because, I think the casual viewer probably thinks that you swing at 2 fastballs the same, but you absolutely do not. I mean, it's like one is coming in and down, and then one's like appearing to cut and ride. So for me, game plan against me specifically, especially as we got further in the year, was sink it until 2 strikes and then maybe go 4-seam. But I rarely got 4-seam before 2 strikes. It was just kind of a lot of sinkers in on my hands, and Zach's got a really, really good one. So just you have to both time 96 and then you have to time the correct 96. You got to pick which ones. You got to either time the 4-seam 96 that's kind of riding up and away from you, or the sinker 96, which is coming down and in on you. So it's 2 different pitches, and it makes the approach and the ability to execute the approach that much more complicated.
Sounds like a fun job.
Hey, you did. It is, he did okay. You did okay this year.
Brent's like, it's incredibly difficult. I wouldn't trade for the world.
It is. I have to be both one of the most difficult and most fun jobs that there is. Brent Rooker, you have been fantastic on this
before
episode.
Before we get out of here, you get to plug one breakfast place. I mean, you tweeted the whole list out.
Yeah.
You get one bullet here on the Baseball Barbercast. If you are giving a recommendation, best breakfast you had this year, where are you sending people?
If I had to plug one place, I would say Toast in Birmingham, Michigan. I love that place. Good vibes. The banana cold brew is unbelievable. The bacon fried rice is really good. That's where I would, I'd send people there.
Toast in, that is Toast close in enough Birmingham, to where I Michigan. Live. I will maybe have to make a pilgrimage to Birmingham, Michigan. Pilgrimage, by the way, RIP, the Plymouth Pilgrims don't exist anymore. I just learned that during this podcast. Plug.
Yeah, they shut down a couple years ago. So.
Oh, man. Well, but don't worry. The Newport Gulls are still running things. So they have Newport the best Gulls record this year. So. Brent Rooker, this has been fantastic. Again, if you want to read more about Brent's breakfast preferences, our good friend Matthew Robertson wrote a whole interview with him for GQ, which I recommend checking out. And I guess follow Brent on Twitter because you've been tweeting like crazy.
Brent, where can people find your work?
Let's see. Twitter is Brent_Rooker12. Instagram is Brent_Rooker19.
And then makes MLB sense. TV during the year, we can find you there.
MLB TV?
Yeah, that's, we can find you.
Yeah, wherever the Oakland Athletics are playing, I should be there. Yeah,
cool.
Yeah.
Got it. Got it. Cool.
I should be in a few of those games.
Okay, also, got it. Yeah, we'll see you there.
So yeah. you're Brent Rooker 12 and Brent Rooker 19, but you wear 25. Just understand.
Yeah. So 19 was, I'll explain this real quick. 19 was always my thing. Like high school, college, I was always 19. So at one point they were both 19. Then I got traded. I never changed it when I was in Minnesota. I got traded to San Diego, changed the Twitter handle to 12, lost my verification because I changed my thing. And I just haven't changed it from there. But I never changed Instagram because it seems too complicated. So I should probably go 25 on both mediums, but I haven't done.
And your daughter seems to agree. Brent Rooker,
she's ashamed.
This has been a delight. We hope you enjoy the remainder of the postseason. We hope everyone enjoyed having your insight. You can follow him on all those relevant platforms. Thank you all for listening. We will be back on Wednesday. We will see how many series have concluded by then. But thank you to Chris Tyler for producing. You can email us at baseballbarbacast@gmail.com. That's BARBcast. Rate and review the pod wherever you get your podcasts. Let us know what you think. And if you really enjoyed this, maybe we'll have Brent return at some point this postseason. But we will leave him to his tweeting and his breakfast recommendations.
And fatherhood.
And fatherhood. Clearly, that is going to be a focus as soon as we get off this Zoom call. But thank you, Brent. We appreciate it. And everybody, we'll talk to you guys on Wednesday.
Thank you, guys. Appreciate it. Had a blast.
SiriusXM Podcasts.